Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The Eurasian Economic Union, Moscow's dream project to create a barrier-free economic zone in former Soviet space, turned 2 years old just last month. But it is far from even getting closer to its original idea. So far, having attracted only five countries, membering states are already frustrated. Kyrgyzstan complains about Kazakhstan's restrictions, and Belarusia frustrated from Russia's approach on issues involving various aspects of the union. So there are lots of questions. Moreover, instead of rise, the trade turnover of some countries have drastically declined with the other membering country in the economic alliance. And on the top of that, China is moving ahead, apparently with a competing project called Obor. Now, 2 years on, where are we with this project? And what the future holds to it in this increasingly challenging environment? Today, on this episode of Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast, we hope to bring some clarity to this and many related questions. To discuss the subject, I have Edil Baysalov, who is the former presidential chief of staff in President Otunbayeva's administration. Edil is joining us today from Bishkek. Edil, welcome to the Majlis.
Hello, Mohammed.
Asim Tokayeva, correspondent at Kazakh Service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is joining us with her insights on Kazakhstan. And also, next to Asim is sitting Bruce Panier in Prague, who's the editor of Kishlok Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. Bruce, Asim, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. John McLeod is tuning in from London, who is the senior CIS analyst at the Oxford Analytica. I spent most part of my evening yesterday reading about this project. I admit my knowledge of economy and trade is below average, but there are things which doesn't make sense. So let's try if we can bring some clarity to this. To do so, please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree with points other guests are making directly. Please don't wait for me to prompt your question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, Edil, let's start with you. So Kyrgyzstan joined the alliance a little bit later, but overall, it's been 2 years since this project was kicked off. What have been some of the visible impact of this project in your country?
So the main consensus, I think, is that our joining came at a very bad time, but more so that our government handled the negotiations well and that shock to our economy and it was stronger than we expected. And so far, our losses have outweighed benefits. But the main visible result is, of course, positive result, if you want, comes with our labor migrants in Russia, who are now, in difference from migrants from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they don't have to buy patents, they are treated without discrimination, they receive entrance to many segments of the labor market restricted to our Central Asian neighbors.
Yes, the positive note is well taken, but again, in the same line you mentioned, Edil, that two very negative aspects of the project, like you said, shocks were stronger than you expected, and also you said we experienced losses. Can you be a little bit specific about these two aspects that you mentioned?
You know, the first year of our joining this Eurasian Union, we experienced a catastrophic decline in our champion industry, in our textile, garment. Hundreds of thousands of our labor was involved in that sector. And then, of course, we had, and it shrunk in quite a dramatic scale. You know, I will just give you the example. You know,
sure.
If in 2012, in the peak year of our garment industry, we produced for $204 million, then last year we produced only, around $9.6 million. It was around 20 times less. Some people questioned this data, but and we had debates last summer and in autumn in our political debates, but in all national statistics, they confirmed this data.
Sorry for pressing you on this, Edil. So what this decline, this shrinking various aspects of the industry had to do with the membership of the Eurasian Economic Union? Any clear-cut evidence?
Many people believe that that the cost of Chinese garment has increased, but also many people believe that lots of our garment industry relocated to areas around Moscow because we became more employable in around Moscow, and Russian government also taking lots of industry to develop garment industry in Russia and providing some subsidies and some creating special conditions. And also the prices went lower thanks to this devaluation of this Russian ruble. We believe that lots of our industry not only just shut down, but actually relocated to Russia. Hmm. It was complete opposite of what we wanted to achieve, of increasing number of jobs here in our country.
Yeah.
And the same, for example, to the cigarette factory here in Bishkek, Riemstma, owned by a German group, it just shut down because the sole meaning of having a cigarette factory in Bishkek now lost sense because you can increase production at the Riemstma factory in Almaty and just ship production here, ready goods, because no barriers, no customs exist now between Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan.
Interesting. I also have a number in my reach now that in 2016, Kyrgyzstan's trade with Eurasian Economic Union member countries declined nearly by 20%. Interesting development. So, Asim, Kazakhstan being a founding member of the project, so what has been the impact, visible impact on the ground of this membership to your countrymen and women?
The tension you mentioned at the beginning and what we observe right now in terms of Eurasian Union reveals us a systematic crisis in this organization. So it's supposed to create effective partnership for the sake of mutually profitable economic relations. In fact, we observe many evidence of issues among members of this union. And we still do not see this single market as it was declared. Recently, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko publicly accused Russia of trying to bolster its influence over his country, but by pushing to control its energy pipelines and using oil and gas supplies as a leverage. After that, his press office informed about a telephone conversation between Lukashenko and President of Kazakhstan, Nazarbayev. And according to this information, Nazarbayev also expressed concern about problematic issues in relations between Russia and Belarus. And he suggested to solve all existing problems within the union.
Yeah, Asim.
Usually Nazarbayev is not so vocal in terms of issues with Russia, but it does not necessarily mean that he is soft. A lot of experts say, even in Russia, but Kazakhstan increasingly concerns over the Eurasian Union.
No, I was also reading some news material about the telephone conversation between Lukashenko and Nazarbayev. Obviously, they mentioned words like existing problems, that issues requires attention, solutions, and all these things. But wording was so hidden. What really they were trying to point at?
If you look at the figures, like statistics, so you also mentioned that Kyrgyzstan's export to country of this union declined.
Mm-hmm.
So I can also tell you figures on Kazakhstan.
Mm.
So the balance of trade is unfavorable to Kazakhstan also. According to statistics, exports to the union countries in last 9 months of 2016 totaled about $3 billion, which is against of $6.5 billion of import, and actually export numbers is already for 31.6% lower than it was in 2015.
interesting points. And another number that I have with me, it says that Kazakhstan's northern region has seen 26% decline in its trade with Eurasian Economic Union members. John or Bruce, feel free to take the microphone. How to explain this?
I'll let John go first.
Yeah, well, I think these problems are all functions of the actual structural imbalances in the Eurasian Union. I mean, one thing, of course, is that as almost every institution, when you look back at it, it started at the wrong time. It started at a time when Russia's economy went into decline and Russia's relationship with the West deteriorated sharply. And that required a response some way from particularly the Kazakhs and the Belarusians. They found that very difficult. But you have this problem, which is in any association. You have a European Union, of course. You have rich and large economies and small and weak ones. But because we have a small number of economies here, we have one absolutely dominant economy, the Russian one, even despite the recession. But then you have the two middleweight players who kind of chafe under Russia's kind of economic developments, the Kazakhs and the Belarusians. And at the bottom, you have the Armenians and the Kyrgyz who are really struggling to benefit. And in the Kyrgyz case, they can hope maybe to benefit in another way from migration, as was mentioned. So I think it is a structural thing. It's not helped, of course, by, as I said, the way it started, in that initially it was just conceived theoretically as a kind of economic union, but there always this kind of political undercurrent. For example, would it have a political superstructure? Would it use the ruble one day? And that issue became all the more acute with Russia's intervention in Ukraine. The Kazakhs and the Belarusians and the Armenians had to respond to that in some way. And of course, they felt that they couldn't go along with Russia all the way, at least on that issue. So that's another, if you like, another defect of a structural defect of the Eurasian Union that differentiates it from the European Union, is that it can't really operate as a kind of external player, because the members genuinely don't have a common position on say Ukraine, and they also have kind of disagreements with one another. For example, the Russian Belarusian trade row, which is about all sorts of things, the Kyrgyz unhappiness with Kazakhs' treatment of it within the union. All these issues tend to divide members, whereas the union should be actually resolving them fairly quickly. So while the union offers them theoretically many, many ways of fixing old economic problems and kind of relationship problems between economies that were once closely connected to one another, the politics of recent years and the imbalances in the union members' economies have obstructed progress. So that the union just hasn't emerged as a strong independent voice that says, right, we must all agree on this system and we will all observe it. And in fact, Russia's in dispute with Belarus must be resolved. In fact, what we see is say, the Russian-Belarusian dispute overriding all of the Eurasian Union's provisions, and it's played out in a very unpleasant and unseemly manner.
Obviously, we are going to talk about what's going wrong in this project in the second half of the debate, but Bruce, jump in, please, about how do you see this is working out in the light of these drastic decline, at least talking about Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan in this case.
First, it's right that people have already noted that this came at a bad time, considering the Russian economy is taking a hit still and still has sanctions put on it from Western countries. So it certainly wasn't the most opportune timing. There's no doubt about that. You know, I mean, this organization has actually been around for about 20 years. It keeps being revived, and Putin's certainly put a lot of effort into trying to make it work this time. But there's a lot of things that they haven't worked out internally, the mechanisms for trading and stuff. That's why we find these strange problems that pop up about, sanitary controls, for instance, quality of goods is one of the things that's come back to haunt them again and again in the Kazakh-Russian case, certainly, where Kazakhstan wants to export some kind of produce or meat or something like that. And then they find out that Russia has unilaterally decided that they were going to have a new requirement that went with crossing into Russian territory with these exports, and it gets blocked at the border, and Kazakhstan's complained about that, and even transit, which should be unified at this at this point. You know, there should be standard charges for whatever, roads, railways, things like that. And we just saw that Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan at the start of this year had a problem. Kyrgyzstan was trying to export dairy products and also meat, I think. And they had a problem with the tariffs for railway use in Kazakhstan. You know, so there's a lot of the internal mechanisms about how this organization is supposed to work that apparently still haven't been well thought out and developed, certainly to the satisfaction of all the members.
Then what's wrong with Vladimir Putin? Obviously, he's on his way to Central Asia in a few matter of days. But a few days ago, he was hailing the outcome of the project, saying that the five countries have already created a large common market and membering countries are working to remove additional barriers, etc. So where his information is coming from?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's all negative. I think the story is could have been, of course, much better if we didn't have the crisis in Russia and all of that. Because in our country, the main benefit is in better conditions of for our labor migrants. And whereas we saw decline labor remittances for Uzbekistan and Tajikistan migrants, our numbers actually increase. And of course, we can decry that even more of our men and women now moving to Moscow and other big Russian cities. You know, they actually are very happy. I've spoken last week and met with several of them. They are celebrating that in Russia they don't have now these hurdles, that, for example, starting January 1st, they will receive same access to healthcare system of Russia on the same conditions as Russian citizens. But with all this dynamic, actually, of course, we see some very crazy developments. For example, we learned today of the new legislation being developed by the Russian government to close the loophole for the banned European or other produce that is being resold, repackaged and resold as Belarusian or Kazakh good to Russia, that they will introduce even more border control. So it is the story no less than absurd sometimes, because more and more barriers are being introduced at the same time as we were promised that actually it will be open borders. Now, starting, I think it's May 1st or June 1st, we are going to accept very, very high standards and harsh standards of this Eurasian Economic Council in milk processing and in meat processing. And not only we will not be able to sell this meat produced in our country, as we cannot sell it even today because we lack all those laboratories and we don't pass the sanitary conditions, but even on our own territory, we will not be allowed to consume our own meat, which comes from the bazaars in Kyrgyzstan, because the new regulations state that all meat must be cut, still and sheep must be cut. Very high standard meat processing plants.
Interesting comments, Edil. But then the question raises, like, if you know this stuff, then the countries like Moldova in Tajikistan, authorities should know about these restrictions and possible negative aspects that you were talking about, Edil. Then why those five other countries I saw in the list of prospect members for this Eurasian Union, why they wanting to join this?
Mohammed, I think, you know, many things have changed since 2013. You know, many things have changed. I mean, one, of course, shocking illustration is in dollar terms, trade between Kazakhstan and Russia almost halved between, 2013 and 2016. They used to sell turnover was $23 billion. Now it's less, around $12 billion. But I will point to you that, you know, it's geopolitical, very global scale, you know, maybe it's about oil price, but it's, of course, huge shock of the Russian economy with the sanctions and other things. But I want to draw your attention and attention of other panelists to one big development. You know, of course, the big story also what's happening in Belarus. You know, Lukashenko is, of course, the, if one person can destroy the whole Eurasian Union, is, of course, Lukashenko. And it's very interesting how, you know, Russian-Belarusian split on this matter is going to play out.
Mm-hmm.
But one very big development, besides all these geopolitical stories, is, of course, huge change in Tashkent. And initial steps, at least until very recently, the first steps of the new Uzbek leader, President Mirziyoyev, were so hopeful that actually, if it proceeds at some scale, if Uzbekistan actually will open up, if Uzbekistan will put, you know, off these barriers.
But he already said that he's not going to put Uzbekistan in any alliance in the region.
No. We don't need that alliance. But if they're going to open borders for some trade with Kyrgyzstan, with Kazakhstan, with Tajikistan, the whole idea of us needing markets elsewhere, thousands of kilometers from here, actually, we will be enough.
Yes, you rightly mentioned when and if it happens. But again, coming back to this Eurasian Economic Union project, Bruce, John, Assem, please feel free to jump in. In the light of all these problems, drastic decline in trade between these countries, membering countries to this organization, in the light of all these negativity, why you find some other countries trying to get into this bloc, like Tajikistan is one of them. Moldova is, I think, on the line. A few other countries where I don't remember what their names at this moment, but there are interest to it. Why they are wanting to join a party which is dying?
I wouldn't say it's dying. It's rumbling on, it's trundling on, and will continue to exist. And I suppose what we're looking at is really its prospects for expanding into what it aims to be, and I'm not entirely sure that it can do that just yet, partly because Russia's own economic prospects are sort of modest. You know, we're not going to see massive recovery, massive growth figures for the next few years. But that aside, Russia that is the draw, basically, because I think that the bulk of member states' trade is bilateral with Russia, and each one has its own sort of specific nature and interest that it pursues. For example, in the case of Kyrgyzstan, it's the migrant labor issue. I would say that would apply also for Tajikistan, whose economy is generally quite weak. Yeah. Of course, and reliance on Russia, including for investment. So I would say it's a fairly natural fit for Tajikistan to go for Russia, even if it does benefit, and I'm sure it will, if Uzbekistan becomes a little more open and a little less hostile than it has been over time. So, you know, you can see reasons why countries would join. At the same time, Moscow is also trying to attract certain countries for, if you like, political reasons as well as economic. Azerbaijan would be a case that Moscow would be interested in drawing it closer, but that here the kind of intra-union differences show up, because you obviously have Armenia, which would be totally against this, and it would seek support. And Azerbaijan would have friends within the union who would support it. So it becomes more complex. Moldova might be another case under its new president, although it has to be said the government remains pro-Western. But the new president is showing signs of wanting to move closer to Moscow. So inviting it to have some kind of relationship with the union, if not join, would be a natural way of engaging him politically, even though Moldova's trade is substantially with the European Union now, and its migrant workers, many of them go to Southern Europe. So the actual logic might not be there. So I think it's a mixture of politics and economic pragmatism.
If I could just jump in too for a second, I would mention that John's given us kind of like the carrot reasons for why some of these, certainly the countries in Central Asia, would want to join. But there was also, Russia also has, there's a stick to this that goes on too. And Adil will certainly remember when, for instance, when Joomar Totorbayev was the prime minister of the country, he kind of conceded that they really didn't have a choice because, you know, their neighbors, China on one side, and then Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan was really their big gateway and a major source of trade in northern Kyrgyzstan. And when Kazakhstan and Belarus and Russia formed this economic union, they did impose these kind of tariffs and duties that were disadvantageous to outside partners potential partners. And so, for instance, the Dordoy Bazaar market in Bishkek kind of dried up because they were used to trading with Kazakhstan all the time. And all of a sudden, to get goods across the border, there was this fee that you had to pay. And Tajikistan is now in that same situation where, there's not many outlets for them to get things in or out of the country. There's very poor import-export routes. They're against China in the corner. Afghanistan's to the south. That's not very, very good for their trade. Adil mentioned Uzbekistan is opening up now, and that's a hopeful sign for the region. We don't know how that's going to go, but, certainly for the last decade or so, Uzbekistan has kept its borders closed for the most part. So that's not hasn't been a trade partner for Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan either. So you kind of end up being isolated if you don't join the Eurasian Economic Union, and it works against your economy.
Very interesting.
If I could just add that, in a way, if you do join the union, you're also isolated because part of the benefit of being in the European Union has been that you can trade, you get to trade with the outside world as part of an almighty bloc. Whereas the trend in the Eurasian space has been for countries to be kind of required to abjure relationships, particularly say with Kyrgyzstan, with China, in favor of intra-union trade and other relationships. So one comes at the expense of others. So you find yourself, yes, there may well be advantages to trading with the huge Russian market, but you're sort of cutting off your external relationships at the same time.
Interesting.
Bruce, I want to disagree with you that we didn't have a choice. Obviously, it was a big political project of our Russian partners or masters. As they were perceived by the government of Otarbayev and by President Atambayev himself. And so without really negotiating with Kazakhstan, without really reaching agreement with Kazakhstan, without building the infrastructure of the whole, laboratories for all those meat and milk and some other technical regulations, we insisted, and actually, Russia made Kazakhstan to accept. Both Kazakhstan and Belarus were very lukewarm or actually quite opposed to our membership. They did not want Kyrgyzstan to become a member, but it was, Russian Kyrgyz insistence, and we were accepted to that union. President Atambayev completely forgot that even after joining the union, he's not going to suddenly receive access to Russian border. He still has to manage relations with President Nazarbayev. We still have to install those laboratories. We still have to prove that, we meet all the standards. That was the thing. I would like to explain that I think we joined, and I know firsthand why everyone was so much, they thought that, we did not have a choice. It was only because we were afraid. There is this national fear, the main national nightmare that we have. We were imagining that if Moscow grows unhappy with us, they will throw out our labor migrants.
Interesting.
The same to Georgians or partially to Moldovans. And of course, that would never happen. That would never take place. Already hundreds of thousands of our labor migrants there, they have Russian passports. It did not happen to Uzbekistani immigrants, though they not only Eurasian Union, they don't care about being a member of CSTO. And actually, I also would like to point to the reality on the ground. What is our main trade with Russia? We don't buy anymore all the machinery, all the equipment. The only thing we receive from Russia, other than, of course, huge transfers of labor earnings, it's oil, it's benzene, it's, of course, without duties. That's very important. We would still have it, I would agree. And the whole huge elephant is, of course, China. China, I'd like to point to statistics, of the last year. It is 30% of our external turnover, whereas, Russia is around 20%, including most of it is, of course, $600-700 million of worth of car gasoline that we receive from them. And Kazakhstan only 15%.
Interesting. Feelings are mixed, obviously. There are, negative aspects and, yes, potential benefits such as finding new treating partners in a safer or easier environment for the labor migrants in Russia. So we will continue talking about this in many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like the Mejlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Mejlis RFRL's Central Asia podcast, we are discussing Moscow's flagship economic project, the Eurasian Economic Union, and what the future holds to it in the face of increasing domestic and regional challenges. Discussing the subject with me are Edil Baysalov, former presidential chief of staff in the President Otunbayeva's administration in Kyrgyzstan, Asan Tokayeva, correspondent at Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Kazakh services, joining us together with Bruce Panier. Bruce is the editor of Kishlak Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. And John McLeod is joining us from London, who is the senior CIS analyst at the Oxford Analytica. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Mejlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And now let's bring Asam here, who have been quiet for some time. Edil mentioned that China makes up Kyrgyzstan's 30% external turnover. Now you have China's Obor project, that is One Belt, One Road project. And I believe most of the countries in Central Asia is excited about it. Where does this put future of Eurasian Economic Union in Kazakhstan, Asam?
I think that Kazakhstan just trying to deal with all situation and following his policy of multi-vector policy and trying to be good with everyone.
Right,
and China is a huge, huge partner of Kazakhstan, and it, of course, it's a neighboring country, and it's invest a lot. It's a big investment after it's one of the biggest, I think, and with Russia and U.S.
Bruce, do you see Obor a kind of competing project against the Eurasian Economic Union, and how these two projects can go side by side?
I mean, obviously, it's going to be some competition. There's no doubt about it. Russia has been in an interesting situation with the Central Asian countries for a long time because of Chinese presence, growing presence in the Central Asian region for a while. There's a lot of things Moscow would like to have greater influence over in Central Asia. But at the same time, China's got the finances to really get the region going, moving forward economically in a lot of ways and connecting it to parts of the world that Russia cannot help Central Asia connect to. So Russia's, one example is, of course, the Turkmen gas pipeline to China. Would Russia rather be selling that gas to China? Of course it would. But this is one of those things where Russia has to maintain good ties with China all the time for economic and political reasons. Obor is going to be competition. I don't think Moscow, certainly now, is not in a position to draw the line anywhere and say, this is the limit of how much expansion we're willing to tolerate from the Chinese. And of course, to be fair too, the Chinese are not billing this as a project that benefits China or a Chinese project anyway. When they talk about Obor, they say it's connectivity, but they expect all the countries that are participating that are along these various routes will come up with their own financing and come up with some of their own ideas on the way too. So at least they portray it as being a real multinational effort. Now, we know that the impetus for this whole thing is all coming out of Beijing, and they're the ones that are pushing it forward. But when they talk about it, they make it sound like everyone gets a share of the pie and we're all going to be involved and we're all going to profit off of this. And like like I said, given the that Moscow or Russia and China have a very, very large border, and Russia would also like to sell a lot of its gas and oil to China. Kremlin is in a real delicate position right now as to how much it can oppose any of the moves that China is making in Central Asia.
John, you want to jump in here? I mean, how do you see these two projects working together nicely?
Well, I guess the problem with them is that they're led by states that are trying to pretend that they're not rivals. But in a sense, in a normal world, you could see them as complementary almost. That one is about the former Soviet Union, where states have common economic interests and trade with one another, principally. And the Chinese one is a whole different order. It spans sort of from Europe to Asia in concept, and is all about, as Bruce said, connectivity. So you could say that they could almost be complementarity. And then separately, you have, if you like, the China-Russian economic and other relationship. I think the Chinese will be very cautious about pushing any broader kind of agenda, certainly no political agenda, because they understand that this is not their sphere of influence in Moscow's eyes. So I mean, the other thing about them in crude terms is that they can actually deliver when they decide to build something like, say, the Turkmen pipeline. They build it, and they make all of the diplomacy, the complex interstate diplomacy, they make all that work. And that kind of ability is a whole different order from what Russia brings to bear. Russia brings to bear a deeper historical knowledge and understanding of its neighbors, but the relationship is somewhat different. China is the big outsider whose intentions are not entirely clear. Russia is the big neighbor whose intentions are generally known and are sometimes suspect.
Okay, in 1 minute or less, the final question is, so what do you see when looking into the future of Eurasian Economic Union? Please, we have to conclude the discussion. Bruce, starting from you.
I think it's wholly dependent on Vladimir Putin. As long as he's in charge of Russia, he's not going to forget about this project, and he's going to push it forward. If there's some change in leadership and they still haven't got this thing, this union up and going and working to everyone's satisfaction, I think it'll suffer the same fate that it suffered several times already. It won't totally go away, but it'll be largely forgotten and kind of fade back into the background for a while.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
I agree with Bruce. Ultimately, these tensions reflect the fact that Russia believes it has a privileged sphere on influence in Central Asia. And I think it's if members of this union would focus mostly on economy rather than politics, so this union might work later.
Okay. John and Edel, please, briefly.
It's, of course, totally personal capacity. It's a leadership pet project. It's clear that Vladimir Putin sees in this Eurasian Union some sort of new reincarnation of some maybe Soviet Union or some European Union, though we see that they're trying at the same time to destroy European Union. You know, I would wish success at least at this status quo, at least that President Nazarbayev is successful keeping the economic nature of this organization, because we see continuous effort of Moscow to introduce single currency or some political, you know, foreign policy coordination, this type of efforts. At least we hope that it stays where as it is without exceeding its economic nature.
Mm-hmm. John, please, shortly.
Yes, I broadly agree. I think that if you like the good things, the good that we see now, the better treatment of migrants, if they can get the border arrangements to actually work and take precedence over kind of national preference, that will all be good. Okay. I don't see it expanding into a huge institution simply because of the structural imbalances in the thing, namely that Russia is so huge economically and politically, that both the politics and the economic side of Russia, I think, will constrain the development of the union as a separate, independent entity.
Okay, thank you very much, John McLeod, the senior CIS analyst at the Oxford Analytica, and Edil Baysalov, former presidential chief of staff in the President Otunbayev's administration in Kyrgyzstan, Asim Tokayeva, correspondent at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Kazakh service, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Owazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, for your time in thoughts today.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.